From a secret location in room 100 of 540 Jack Gibbs Boulevard, this is Craft. I'm your host, Doug Dangler. Nicholson Baker is a novelist, humorist, and social critic. His most recent release is The Paul Chowder Chronicles, which brings together two novels about Paul Chowder, the anthologist, and Traveling Sprinkler. Baker received a National Book Critics Circle Award in 2001 for his Doublefold, Libraries and the Assault on Paper, a nonfiction look at the decline of paper-based materials being archived by libraries. Nicholson Baker will appear on Tuesday, October 21st, with the ever-excellent Thurber House Evenings with Authors events. Welcome to Craft, Nicholson Baker.
Oh, thank you for having me on your show.
Sure, we're very happy. So tell me about your most recent omnibus, the Paul Chowder Chronicles. Will more Paul Chowder books be forthcoming, or does an omnibus signal sort of the completion of a cycle? What's your take on that?
I have a sneaking suspicion that there will be more, but the thing that was fun about this book is it put two books together that were published by two different publishers. I had the same editor for both books, and they decided to put them together because they do sort of form a whole. And the nice thing is you start reading one and you get towards the middle and finish, and then you flip the book over and you start reading the other. So it's, I don't know, there was a children's book I had a long time ago that did that. Mm-hmm. And I kind of like the idea that you burrow towards the middle of the book. Okay. But there'll probably be other Chowder installments. I like this character because he's fun, and it helps me get out what I have to say.
All right. Now, it's been suggested that Paul Chowder shares perhaps some qualities with you. What kind of conscious selection do you do about representing a character that is obviously fictional, but one that's so often conflated with you? Is that something you think about while writing?
I guess all of my novels have been pretty autobiographical. I think it's more fun to try to cut very close to the truth, and sometimes it's just too complicated to tell what actually happened, because it's one of those things where you say, well, then on Tuesday, and then somebody called me back, and it gets too, so some of the reasons that you write something and call it fiction is just that you get to clean up a few things in a way that makes more sense, is less confusing for the reader. But it's also that it's a pleasure to come up with a person who isn't quite you, but into which, like a ventriloquist, you can send all of your true opinions. You can tell the truth, but via this character, you have a sort of a scrim or a shield behind which you can hide, I guess.
Okay, and that keeps you from getting in trouble with anybody who might appear in your life, and also in these books, it's a good way to get out of trouble. To get out of jail free.
Nobody. I don't think anybody's going to have any trouble with. It's not a legal thing so much as just a kind of feeling of I want to tell this thing truthfully, and then when I try to tell it, as I did with this second book in this two book little paperback collection, I tried to write it as a work of nonfiction about what it was like to rediscover music and try to write a protest song, a love song, in my 50s. And I got I was all cramped up because it was me, and I'm carrying all the meanness with me. Whereas if I have another guy who's out there, who's struggling, who's living very close to where I live, who has a dog the way I do, but who doesn't have a wife and children the way I have, he's just had a slightly sadder life, I guess, is what the difference between him and I'm a lucky guy. I've had a very happy life. In some ways, novels have to have more obstacles and things going wrong in order for them to stay interesting.
It's funny, a novelist friend of mine once referred to all fiction as people doing terrible things to each other. That was his take on fiction. So,
well, and that's always bothered me, actually, because I think, isn't fiction supposed to be about life, about what life actually is, and why is it that it's as if a fiction writer sits down in front of an amplifier and cranks up all the dials, in order to make it more interesting. But I think if you just, what you need to do is just tweak the dial slightly. Mm-hmm. Just change the balance slightly. Maybe put up the bass a bit, and then it sounds right. And it's different, but it's true.
Now, that's an interesting analogy, because as you mentioned, you were writing about going back and learning to play or starting to play the bassoon again after, I think you said, 30 years of not having played it. But that's a very musical analogy for someone who hadn't been in music for a while.
Well, I wish I could say, okay, so here's, I was a bassoonist. I actually was a professional bassoonist for a short time. I got a tux and tails, and I was the fourth bassoonist for the Rochester Philharmonic, and I was part of the musicians union, and it was fun, but I don't have the fundamental talents of a real musician, but I had a kind of a fast finger technique and stuff. All those years went by, and I was also a would-be composer back then. When I rediscovered music and bought some software, fancy composing software, I didn't actually take up the bassoon again because I've messed up my jaw. When I first played the bassoon, I also wrecked my jaw with a basketball that came flying up and hit me in the jaw and kind of dislocated my jaw. And so I played the bassoon with my jaw out of joint for a while, and it's never been right since. So I didn't feel that I wanted to take up the bassoon again, but I had all of that kind of pent up, all those memories of what it's like to sing your way with an instrument through a phrase, and I just missed music, you know. I really had given it everything I had when I was in my late teens and early 20s, and now it was just felt like it was time to get back to it and see what was still there.
Mm-hmm. Now, I'm curious, when you started composing and you said you got software for it, how similar did that feel to, say, writing? When you're doing fiction, do those things have some overlaps, or did you feel like they were completely different from each other? Because I've done a very, very small amount of each, and I could see someone who's talented at it might feel like they're exercising the same kind of part of their brain.
Well, when it's going well, I think writing is very difficult, so it's not always going well, but there is a kind of a complete feeling of being absorbed, swimming in what you're doing and having your attention completely focused on some tiny intricacy of a sentence and making it better. That's very exciting, and the hours fly by. And the same thing is really true when you're working on a piece of music. You've got, say, two bars that are giving you trouble, and you loop through them, think, and go over and over until you've got something that sounds a little bit better, trying another thing. In that sense, it's very similar, even though I think music and writing really use entirely different parts of your mind. I can't do the two at the same time, oddly enough. In this basic sense that I was writing the work of fiction, writing the work of nonfiction about trying to write a song, and I would have to, in the end, had to stop working on all the songs in order to write the book, and the book then metamorphosed into this work of fiction. And somehow you have to shut down one part of your mind and give everything you have to the art form, whatever it is in front of you. I mean, it's not as if it's hard to do these things, and I'm a person of limited capacity, so I need all the help I can get. I need both lobes of the brain at one time.
You know, when you said that, I just had for a momentary, I laughed because I had in mind, composing a song at the same with like one hand and writing a novel with the other, two keyboards going on, and I don't know why that jumped to mind, but it made me laugh, and I'm sure that's not what you meant, but that's the way my mind works. I'm curious about another aspect of some of the things that you've been working on. You got an award in 2001 for your work on talking to libraries or advocating to libraries about paper preservation. And I'd like to touch on that just for a moment. There's a reason why. Earlier this week, I went to my local library to get a copy of a journal that was published this month. Now, they receive an electronic copy, but no physical copy. And sadly, I found that there's an 18-month embargo on the electronic version, which I said to the librarian, doesn't that put me somewhat far behind? And I'm curious, given your interest in paper preservation, how often do you hear stories like this? Are they increasing in number? Is that something that's even more on your mind?
Well, I think we're getting a little better at understanding the difference between keeping a physical thing that came off a printing press in, whatever, 1943, and keeping the digital copy of that thing. The strange phenomenon that I was trying to chronicle in Double Fold, which is the book about all this, was that libraries, especially in the 60s, 70s, 80s, were so excited about a new, at the time, new fancy technology of called microfilm, where you took a big newspaper page and took a 35-millimeter shot of it, and it was all hyper modern and exciting because it was now on film, and libraries did this like crazy, and then federal money got involved, and since libraries are chronically underfunded, this was the only kind of, this was the incentive they had, was to take the federal money to microfilm things and throw away the originals. And we really did that to an extreme degree in research libraries, especially the Library of Congress and the New York Public Library, the great, big, huge libraries that researchers go to. We did that for some years, and the losses have been gigantic. So that was what the story that I was trying to tell, was that this was a mistake and that we could learn from it. And I think we have learned from it in the sense that one of the things that the web shows you is that it's really nifty to be able to look at, let's say, a Pulp Fiction paperback cover from the 50s, and it speaks to you because it's a scan of the original thing. It's not a scan of a black and white photograph taken at the time. It's a picture. So you always want to hold on to the original because there's always going to be a new way to take a picture of something. And that's what museums have always understood. That you, just because you can take a picture of something doesn't mean you take the painting off the wall, obviously.
Right. Mm-hmm. So do you think that you said at the beginning you thought that that's been successful, or that you feel better about the ways that libraries are approaching preservation these days? Is in the past 10 years it's turned a tide maybe for you?
Well, I don't want to say this, but I mean, it's just that there are indications that people get it more. Okay. But the Library of Congress and places like that, the last time I checked, they were still cutting old bound volumes of newspapers out of the bindings. It's called guillotining, and then making microfilm copies, because it's something that always happened. And there's a department. When you set up a department with staffers and everything, they have to have something to do. And so the libraries fed them with this never-ending tide of often newsprint. So that continues. It's just that I know that there were some libraries who said, beautiful four-color pictures, and we're replacing them with high-contrast, little tiny 35-millimeter panes of plastic. That doesn't make any sense. And these things are rarer, you say, than, you know, Gutenberg Bibles? Well, let's rethink that. And so some libraries really did rethink their policies. But there's still a gigantic hole in our history as a result of a mistake that great, noble research library institutions made some decades ago.
Well, speaking of research librarians, and maybe going even a little further back, when you were in school, you were an English major. And no doubt did a lot of research in libraries then. And this is something that comes off your Amazon page that's in first person, so I'm kind of assuming you wrote this. And you identified as an English major there. Is that a career you recommend to people? Is it a career? What's your take on that now, a few years past being an English major?
Oh, sure. Well, I have a little bit of an unusual background because I went to a public high school that was very experimental, and I didn't have to really do anything at all except what I wanted to do, which was play the bassoon and compose music. And so, and I went for a year to the Eastman School of Music, so I was really a music guy who then decided I wanted to be a writer, transferred to Haverford College, and I had, at that point, complete ignorance about the history of English literature, about what had come before the writers I liked lived, people like Nabokov, the writers I was reading at the time. Who were the poets of the early 17th century? I had no idea. So being an English major was a way of soaking in the past and taking stock of what was there and all the kind of amazing prose stylists that were out there. So sure, it was a lot of fun. I didn't really learn how to write prose in a sense of writing, you know, an essay or something, something publishable in college, although I was sending things out to magazines. But I did learn a lot about what had come before. So yes, I think it's a little bit out of favor as a major because, you know, what are you going to do with that? but I think it's a great way to be forced to read things that you, not only that you didn't want to read, but that you didn't know existed. Mm-hmm. And gradually get a set of all my landmarks were musical. So I knew that, you know, Debussy was around the turn of the century, and then I could go back and I knew when Bach was writing, but I had no literary landmarks in history to attach myself to. So it was great. I would say anybody who wants to be a writer, it's lots of fun. You never know. You think you're not going to like Andrew Marvel, and then it turns out you're going to love him.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, I asked that question. I've got two degrees in English myself, so, you know, I feel some...
Well, you took it further than I did, yeah.
I took it to the ultimate foolish extent. I got a doctorate in it. So, you know, that was really a mistake there.
No. You surely don't say that.
One last question for you, in that you've written fiction, you write for journals, magazines, you've written nonfiction and short stories. Is there a genre left that you're thinking you'd really like to try that you haven't had a shot at yet?
Well, okay. I mean, I would love to write a TV show. Does that count?
Sure.
But when I really want to say something true, it's a very strange process where I often start by writing what actually happened, and then I let it simmer, molder down for a while, and it ends up being something that's, I guess, classed as autobiographical fiction. So no matter what I start out fantasizing about wanting to write, well, I would love also to write a suspense novel. I mean, a really, just an absolutely gripping adventure yarn with lots of chase scenes and stuff like that. I love those kinds of books when they're good. And I try to write them, and I get caught up in the door handle of the car or the shift knob or something of that thing. My foot doesn't get to the pedal quick enough. You know, I don't start going. So regardless of what I want to write, I usually end up writing the same kind of thing I always have written.
I would look forward to a James Bond novel in which he goes to, you know, kill somebody and decides to play the bassoon instead. That
goes out to buy a pair of shoelaces instead. Sure.
Yeah.
Why not?
Well, Nicholson Baker, thank you very much for talking to me today on Craft. We look forward to your October 21st visit to the always excellent Thurber House Evenings with Authors series. Have a great day.
Thank you, Doug. It was a pleasure.
For more information from my guests, visit www.craftheshow.com. This is Doug Dangler. Until next time, be creative.